performance of major projects in the UK. My research expertise is in major programs delivery. I subscribe to views of incrementalism, which I'll touch on later on. So often we tend to saw the branch we sit on, which is argue against building one-off big projects. And I'll walk you through my reasoning using empirical evidence from dams, but the issue is much more general than just big dams. And I have forays into practice via consulting with various organizations. So just to sort of frame the issue, oh, by the way, this is Oxford on an optimistic day. It seems to be more frequent in Cambridge, and that's what it really looks like. So I'll make a few observations with somewhat of a stylized case study about big dams. And I'll give you a slightly cherry-pick theoretical interpretation of those observations, which is not to shut down other potential interpretations, that's just what time will allow today. And then, if we have time, we'll provide three few interventions that I derive out of those interpretations. So just to sort of build the case, put yourself in the shoes of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Prime's the country of my origin. And Pakistan's a country of many rivers, but also a tremendous problem, a paradox, of either too much water in the form of floods, or not enough of it in the form of droughts, and electricity shortfalls. What should we do?
Presume not.
Well, unfortunately, he's prone to bouts of irrationality. So he has chosen to build big dams. And that seems really rather natural. So, you know, huge variation in both the spatial and temporal availability of water and electricity shortage. And putting the two together, big dams seem like a very obvious solution. And what I'll argue is it's almost too obvious. You know, there's evidence that suggests that, you know, why we need something a bit more subtle. Because the course of, like true love, the course of building dams ain't easy. And I'll try to sort of detail that a little bit more. So why we chose dams, partly is personal. I grew up on a dam site called Mangalan, Pakistan. And I was convinced they were God's gift to develop. That they were going to be the way countries like Pakistan, India, or in fact Ethiopia, etc., would move to the next level. Until I met Bent. And Bent was very subtle. And I'm sure you might have come across Bent's work. And he said to me, well, go out and collect some data and see what you find. So I went out and collected data on three dams to begin our study, one of which was Terbeda, the other big dam in Pakistan. I began to quickly realize, gosh, things are not quite what they seem in terms of this obvious solution being for the better. And one of my lessons from this was overcoming my emotion bias in favor of dams when I confronted hard evidence. And a theme I'm becoming theoretically much more interested in, the difficulty of decision makers to overcome their emotional biases in favor of certain favored solutions when they encounter hard evidence. And my suspicion, my conjecture is that it's much harder for experts to overcome entrenched biases than it is for lay people when they confront contrary evidence. And I was lucky that we had this four-year process, and I had a mentor that kind of, you know, encouraged me to do that, and made me much more skeptical about numbers. So numbers in my world now are guilty until proven innocent. And that was not the case before I started this work. And dams are also interesting theoretically because they cover a very wide range of scales. And I was really interested in the notion of economies of scale, which I now call economies of big, to differentiate between big and scalability. I'll come to that later on, but let's just park this idea now. Big is not scale, is a fundamental argument I put forward. So calling them economies of scale is a misnomer. We call them economies of big. So in a way, big dams cover a series of bignesses and make them quite useful to distinguish the effect of bigness on risk. Also, they're quite an abstract asset. So you can't build a 99% complete dam. A bit like a 99% complete bridge of valueless. It's either there or it's not there. So it makes it theoretically quite a neat little asset to look at. it's further improved in its neatness because all the costs incurred up front, and pretty much the entire lifecycle costs are happening at the front of the project with no feedstock costs. So it's not complicated by very difficult math around feedstock. And Nuclear shares some of that characteristics. With the exception, of course, for funeral costs for dams, and they've just never been done. So people haven't removed big dams yet. And it's yet to be seen what those funeral costs look like, and they're probably very, very sizable. Finally, they're meant to be widely standardized technologies. Beavers build dams. Humans have been building dams for 5,000 years. You know, you would expect that this is a pretty easy problem to crack. And if we could find that this is not an easy problem to crack, then we could probably say a little bit more about more complicated projects, more complicated technologies in that. You know, and also challenge the economist notion of economies of scale, which rests on standardized technology as a prerequisite for it to emerge. So the data we studied is 269 projects been added on. The paper that you may have seen reports data on 245 large dams. And now we're beginning to collect data on small dams, and hopefully the database would grow, although finding data is very, very difficult. And the point of this slide really is that it's as representative as we could get. So there's no cherry picking the data. All valid and reliable data we can find was included here. I would make one point in passing. This is still less than 1% of the total large land population in the world. And I worry about the state of democracy in our world, where it's very difficult to collect data on these mega projects, even from democratic governments. And it's really generally very, very difficult to lay hands on original business cases or planning processes that led to the greenlighting of these projects. And certainly, ex post evaluation documents are almost impossible to track. So we did have allies in documents from the World Bank, Asian Development Bank, Tennessee Valley Authority. I've got a paper out from Tennessee Valley Authority, which should be, it's in draft form, if anybody's interested in reading that. Incidentally, very good performance of TVA data. And the other American water agencies. So, conclusions. And I'll rush through this a little bit. More details on the data are in the paper. So I'll rather talk about things that are not in the paper so that you know you can sort of supplement that. First of all, highly asymmetric outcomes. If you subscribe to rational expectations models in economics, you would expect a symmetric distribution around the mean of zero. So mean forecasting error would approximate zero simply as people learn over time and become adaptive and rational. That's not happening here. The distribution is highly skewed towards negative outcomes, which are the cost overruns. Some dams do come under budget. So one in four come under budget or on budget, but three in four blow their budget. Nearly half the dams, 47% to be exact, had a cost overrun of 40% or more. And benefit to cost ratio for a typical dam is 1.4. So even before looking at schedule delay or benefit shortfall, they're already in the territory of busting through their stated benefit to cost ratio. And the tail is very long. This is surprising. It seems like even after it makes sense to abandon a project, decision makers are not abandoning them. So they keep building and finishing a project long after. It's quite clear that no amount of benefits would ever pay back for this project. And that's quite surprising, but literature in psychology in particular talks of escalation commitment, but there's certainly evidence of that in our data. People will look awfully stupid if they abandon a project. So for example, the tunnel collapse in the recent Gibe project in Ethiopia, you know, it probably makes sense to just leave that down alone, but they're not going to. You know, and they will likely incur more and more costs, and it's unclear how much those costs might be to finish that, and it might place it in that long tail by the time the dam is finished. That same pattern is seen globally. North America does better. So the colors are means by region, and the dots are all the dams you know, where our data come from. Soviet Union, we have very little data from, but takes the biscuit for worst performance. North American dams tend to do better, But they also have special features, like all the costs are incurred in US dollars, and in the domestic currency, which is not the case elsewhere. Also, many of them are new deal dams built at a time when there's a lot more slack in the supply chains. There are other, and FDR, in particular, the president, was awfully keen to make sure many of these dams got built on time and budget. So there are multiple reasons that can explain better American performance. One surprising finding, which we sort of haven't done much with, is the number of times one confronts American consultants working on dam projects outside the US. And theories of psychology might suggest that there's an anchoring effect in which their positive American experience with dams is causing them to be more optimistic about dam figures elsewhere. And they're not taking into account other geographic and project management issues that exist outside their country of origin. And it's a completely honest mistake, but human beings, and experts in particular, are quite prone to it, where we might anchor into our experience and not sufficiently adjust for it when we move outside things familiar to us. But it's fairly, point is, it's fairly bad performance. South Asia, incidentally, does worse than Africa, even though it's a big dam building region. It would appear so, yes. Which is, dams like Kariba came in on budget on time. But now it's obviously going to tremendous hassle. The time is when it takes dams in the world. We come back though. But now the Kenji, for example, in Nigeria, they come in considerably over. But it's also produced next to none of its intended benefits. I mean, the portion is really, really small. We're just looking at cost overruns. And that's another thing about hard data. It doesn't always conform with one's preconceived notions. But there's quite a bit of variance in the data, which we're not capturing in this figure.
So if you did it by data building, would you get a gradual worsening over time? I don't know if you're coming on to that.
Essentially, with construction of dams, there's no change in average cost overruns over time. So there's no indication that people are learning.
Right,
but there's not
going
the other way. It's not going the other way.
Because you might think they would pick off the best sites first.
There's no evidence of that in our data sets. And whether the site characteristics, I would suggest, are probably decoupled from their cost overruns. Because even a good site would have reasonable number of its own issues, like with geology and the like. But let's revisit that. That's in the discussion as well. Similar pattern appears in schedule overruns. Judith worked a lot on this. The tails are less fat than they are with costs. So whereas 5,000% cost overrun existed for a dam, this ends in 750, which is a dam in which took nearly 40 years to finish. And this tail might look a little bit fatter for nuclear power plants. So the recently completed Tennessee Valley Authority's Watts Bar 2 in 2007 took nearly 42 years to build as well. Started in 1972, lots of stops and stops. And the idea here is the schedule delay impacts the net present value of benefits and has a big hit on us. But it also impacts the time at which those benefits become available to people. So farmers in Pakistan need the water now. They need the electricity now. If they have to wait 8.6 years, which is the average time of building a dam, they'll be dead by the time these things arrive. So you have to look after their temporal needs now and come up with solutions that can fulfill them, even if it meant eventually building a dam that came online 10 years down the road. But for the moment, that mismatch between need and delivery is simply too large to be acceptable. So fog of time. Now, one of the interesting features of time is it correlates very highly with uncertainty. So the time leads to entropy. And very simple things. This is the optimism of World Bank reporter staff at the start of the project. And this is what actually happened. So in the case of Chibor Dam in Colombia, they write, no allowance has been made for possible future fluctuations of the exchange rate of the peso, Colombian peso against US dollar. This approach is justified by recent experience in Colombia, where the government has been pursuing the enlightened policy of adjusting policy quickly to changing conditions in the economy, which then led to about a 90% short depreciation in the currency after the fact. Now, half the dam is imported in terms of electromechanical, in terms of the foreign consultants. Suddenly, the costs in peso terms for that just have exploded after you get the precipitous exchange rate movement like that. This sort of movement is very common in developing countries, particularly after they embark on a big mega project. Not just dams, but others. Far sharper calls are seen in Argentina, in Mexico, in Turkey, in Yugoslavia. The list goes on. And that has a big contributing effect on sovereign debt, which I'll come to in a second. Itumbiara Dam in Brazil. Before, the cost estimates provide ample physical contingencies, 20% of base cost, which seems quite high, to provide for removal of large amounts of weak rock if further investigations show the need. Whereas they just have to keep digging and digging and digging because the geology was very weak, and it costs 96% cost overrun in real terms after removing the effects of inflation. If you include the effects of inflation, these numbers become mind-boggling, to the degree where we had to go over our calculations hundreds of times because the cost overrun in nominal terms was so large that we thought they had to be incorrect. But the inflation happening in these economies at some of these times is also staggering. So the deflator by which they've been deflated is absolutely huge. Tabela, closer to home for me, they say before, a general contingency of 7.5% has been added in accordance with normal practice for works of this size and duration for inflation. And this is a time when even in Pakistan, these numbers were decided over 3 months' lunch. And unfortunately, the reality is the sobering reality is that actual cumulative inflation during that time was 380%. So it quadrupled the nominal budget. And to be perfectly honest, we are reporting our cost overruns in real terms only because it's economics convention to do so. Any finance person will tell you, you pay your loan back on the nominal cost incurred, not the real cost incurred. It doesn't make sense unless your outputs are inflating at the same rate as your input costs. The two don't cancel each other out, and they're not. The outputs are inflating at a much lower level of inflation than the input costs.
But the real cost of borrowing in some of these periods was remarkably low and probably negative.
Perhaps, and we've removed interest during construction, but I think the evidence you do see is simply the staggering expansion of public debt. And if that were the case, you wouldn't see such large liabilities accruing at the sovereign level.
Yep, the question is, what's happening to those liabilities in dollar terms?
Over time, defaults. It's defaults, a string of sovereign wealth defaults, sovereign debt defaults that are across emerging markets. And Jude and I were talking about this earlier. One can make the case. There's certainly correlation between period one mega project investment and period two sovereign default. I dare say I've seen enough evidence to sense there's causation.
That's the real cost overrun, not the inflation.
That's both the real as well as, it's just this total liability you're swallowing.
Yeah. Real.
Which is why we report real.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. But which is to say, though, but at the same time, the consumers are also losing consumer surplus because they're suddenly now paying much more inflated notion of value.
That's what's happening to them, really.
True. All of that's true, which is why we stick with you. And all the cost overruns are reported in the but it's not to say that inflation, we can't ignore inflation just because we're sticking with
Real exchange rate changes, yes.
Yeah. And I think we'll come back to that. I think the paper on China is more relevant to that in some ways. where there hasn't been a huge amount of inflation recently, but that has still contributed a lot to public debt accumulation. But perhaps we can come back to that again during the discussion. Kenji Dam said, we haven't got that much data on benefits, but this is one perhaps more egregious example where it led to both a very large cost overrun but also a very large benefit shortfall. And before the planner said, the river flow is very regular as regards its timing, and drought was not modeled. And one thing you might see is a constant pattern in which decision makers estimate the variance of what variables they're dealing with to be a lot lower than it actually turns out to be. And it's often because they've got some form of a Gaussian distribution in their minds when they're dealing with these phenomena, and they work with one or two standard deviation changes, whereas the real world is much wilder than that. And I'm not sure whoever came up with this notion that rivers are ever regular, because we've known since the 40s and 50s that they have a fractured structure. They're very wide. It's not very wide, but they're much wilder. They're not as wide as gusts of wind, but they're not weights of rabbits. You know, they are. It's a much wilder distribution than a Gaussian distribution. So how could they ever think that it was going to be regular? Slightly surprising. And I think this issue of people underestimating variance, you know, Daniel Kahneman and other behavioral economists, psychologists, have really picked on as a major issue in decision-making in general, but certainly of great relevance to mega projects. In reality, in Kenji, 75% benefit shortfall, since the store water behind the dam was very low, design capacity was used. The trouble with Kenji has been that it's either drought or flood, which is a very common pattern in rivers. And the flood threatens the integrity of the dam. The drought means it can't produce what it's designed. And Kenji is not unique in facing this biblical dilemma. So sunk costs and debt are reflected in public debt as well. In case of Pakistan, Turbela Dam contributed to a 23% increase in the external debt of the country over the same time period. It's a very, very long construction period because many of the tunnels collapsed at the very last minute, hit by in Ethiopia. Similar thing can be seen at Chibor in Colombia, but at somewhat lower level. Now, what does this all add up to? Is the concept, and this is not in the first paper, which is the one in energy policy, which we now call investment fragility. And investment fragility is a very simple preset threshold at which something breaks, which we've set to be where the benefit to cost ratio slips below one. So that's the point where the net present value becomes less than zero, becomes negative. And the project's economic function is lost. In other words, the asset becomes stranded. Roughly, and again here, the data we have are more limited. We haven't got that much benefits data, but as I'll draw out in a second, benefits for dams are, there's an asymmetry between benefits and costs. Benefits for dams cannot exceed, by definition, beyond their stated design capacity. 1,000 megawatt design dam can't suddenly start producing 2,000 megawatt equivalent electricity. But its costs are effectively an infinite pit if the dam wall starts crumbling, if there's a big earthquake and needs a lot of repair, if there's a big flood, or a tunnel collapses, or there's, you know, a massive environmental event, or whatever. And essentially, these infinite costs can just continue on in perpetuity. It's a bit like what's happened with Kariba at the moment, where the dam wall is quite literally crumbling. And the choices between either allowing a catastrophic failure of the dam wall and just unthinkable downstream costs, or just constantly repairing, a decaying wall. And it's only been around since 1950. It's conceivable that it would stay up for another 10, 15, 20 years, but what about 100 years from now? What about 500 years from now? It will go. And what might the cost look like then? And that, what about Three Gorges Dam? Because ultimately it's a big dam that's just doing this all day long. Eventually, it lands on the snap. You know, it doesn't need to be in the 80-year service life, but you know, from an ecological perspective, these are multi-thousand-year events, big gaps. And have we really costed the whole horizon is unclear. And again, to Simon's point, you know, for big like nuclear, these are intensely long-term events. And human cognition, I'd submit, just does not extend to that. We can't deal with thousand-year risks. And we've shown ourselves to be remarkably poor at that. So as a result of trying to adjust our cognition, which has been the academic agenda, we need to, in my view, adjust our designs to our own abilities. So interpretations. Now, a couple of things. Our data support two sets of theories. One agency theory that suggests that there's a bit of lying going on in the initial estimates, purely because it suits people to lie about. We call it, to be polite, strategic misrepresentation in the literature. The second, which is Machiavellian numbers, crunched purely to make budgets look good. Second, they also support behavioral psychology theories around optimism bias and overconfidence, and just people getting the estimates of tasks wrong, because human beings are quite optimistic creatures, otherwise we wouldn't get out of bed. I'm not going to dwell on those two camps of theories. I'm going to dwell on a third camp of theory, which derives out of notions of empathy, and which we call fragility. So what is investment fragility? Nassim Taleb recently written a book called Anti-Fragility, which is perhaps sort of the most comprehensive notion around this. But the concept of fragility exists in many other fields. Material sciences, with glass, liquid-forming glasses, with human bones, even with personal ethics. We were talking about trust being quite fragile. So the notion is really quite widespread. It simply describes how a system or a material suffers when it encounters a random event. So there's no random event that can benefit this glass of water. A gust of wind, a nervous jerk in my hand, an earthquake, all of it would lead it to either fall and spill its contents or break. It's not going to turn into gold by just sitting there. And there are other things in the world that benefit from random events. So Taleb gives the example of hydrate. You chop one head, two grow. And there are very few things that actually invite randomness. Those he calls anti-fragile. Big projects don't like randomness. They don't like earthquakes. They don't like tsunamis. They don't like tunnel collapses. They like being left alone. And the world is such that it doesn't leave people alone. It's just coming at you. And which we see in the asymmetrical distributions of this. So the die in life is loaded, and it's loaded against you, and wise people understand that. So Stoic philosophy is all about being anti-fragile in ways. It's just understanding that the die is loaded. And then working with that rather than trying to change that. So that exhibits itself in this asymmetric frown, the semi-frown. Where the gains are limited, this is the amount of electricity the dam can produce, whereas the costs are an infinite pit. And at some preset threshold, which is the preset benefit to cost ratio, the total costs will exceed the producible benefits. And that threshold, where area one exceeds area two, is the point of fragility. With a big splash there. Now, there's a more general case of that, which I just described, which is the porcelain cup here, or Humpty Dumpty, and the outcome of fragility is typically irreversible. So once a cup is broken, it's quite difficult to put it together. In case of Humpty Dumpty, all the king's men and all the king's horses couldn't put them back together. And that's the same for big energy meg projects. Once they have suffered fragility, to redeploy them, to do something else, to do something other than what they were designed for, is very difficult. Similarly, because of design limits of the amount of electricity they can produce, they cannot, under any conceivable future, unless suddenly the price of electricity spikes through the roof, would recover their economic function. So once they're broken, you know, they just become dud assets. That's not always the case, as we'll see in a second. And every material has a unique threshold which you can decipher through empirical analysis. So if Humpty Dumpty were made of rubber, it would, you know, the history would look quite different for him. So which means also that you have design choices once you embark on a mega project, because depending on the materials you use, you will have very different outcomes as you go about it. And what I'll submit is that decentralized, modular ways of building energy systems are a bit more like rubber. And big dams, big energy mega projects are a bit like Humpty Dumpty, prone to failure. So map of fragility, there are two sort of things. One is loss of function and function recoverability, and the fragility threshold. So you know, eggs are apparently very fragile, so they have a very low threshold at which they'll break, whereas diamonds have a very, very high threshold at which they'll break. But diamonds also have a very low function recoverability. Once you've smashed it, no amount of glue is going to put it back together. Right? Fungi, on the other hand, have very high fragility thresholds. Very difficult to get rid of a fungus. If any of you have any interest in trees, you know, it's just, you have to give up. And the functional recoverability is also very high. So even if you zap a bit of fungus, it'll figure out a way of growing back again. And I'm interested in building energy systems that look more like fungus. Dams actually make it look more like fungus. Some systems, like a multi-use electric fuse, are designed to be fragile. But the idea is they have a very low threshold of fragility, so they break very easily, in order to protect the bigger system from breakage. But they have a very high function recoverability. That's a minimum first step in order to then get to looking a bit like a fungus. So intrinsic versus inherited fragility. You might all be familiar with the story of Humpty Dumpty, which was actually originally a cannon on a wall in Colchester that the Royalist forces were using to protect against parliamentarians during the English Civil War. And as a mighty cannon, they couldn't quite enter the city, so instead of blowing up the cannon, they blew the wall under it. And the cannon inherited the fragility of the wall and fell to the ground and couldn't be put together again. And the idea is the system itself could be quite robust, but the things that it links to, if they're not robust, the system itself is fragile. In more pithy terms, you're as strong as your weakest link in an interdependent system. So it takes just one very minor fault in a big project for the whole thing to unravel. And that little fault is usually quite hidden, a bit like Achilles' heel. So the story goes that Achilles was dipped in a mythological river in order to make him very robust. And his mother, who was a goddess, dipped him in this great river, and he couldn't be bruised, except for the point where she was holding him, which is his heel. And that's where they got him. The idea being the information conditions to turn an otherwise fragile system completely robust and incredibly strong. And frankly, in my view, if you bring in the psychology into it, unknowable. Because no matter how much you go over that system, you would leave that one little piece that would break and then lead to it being inherited, the harm being diffused through the entire system. So economies of big versus economies of fragility. A lot of big projects are justified for their economies of big. And economists and even management theorists have absolutely obsessed over it since the mid-19th century. But what we are arguing is that this is done at the expense of ignoring the non-linear risks that emerge, the risks of fragility that emerge as those economies of big are acquired. And those risks magnify, we argue, as projects get bigger and bigger. So we're not denying the economies of scale, i.e. persistently declining average cost curves don't exist for some range of output. But what we are arguing is that declining, persistently declining average cost is acquired for a much higher, I'm sorry, much higher risk, which then leads to fragility. And that's born out of complexity, interdependency, and lack of redundancy. So duplication is often a bad term in economics. We argue for duplication.
5 minutes? Cool. So just to wrap up, big versus scalable.
Big is tethered. It's spatially and temporally fixated. Where scalable is freedom from time and space. Scalable as a word really only entered in the 1970s in the English lexicon, largely via computer sciences. To give you an example, Encyclopedia Britannica is big. It's tethered to the particular shelves of the library in which it's sat. Wikipedia is scalable. Anybody, anywhere, anytime can access it and read it. It's not perfectly scalable because you still need the internet to do it. So in some ways, achieving perfect scalability is very difficult, but Wikipedia is far more scalable than Encyclopedia Britannica. The fundamental proposition we have advanced in the second paper, which is Biggest Fragile, coming out as a book chapter in an OUP volume, is fragility arises when big is forced into doing what was best left to the scale. And this is particularly relevant because bigness has some scalable properties in the range of its design capacity. So a big nuclear power plant like Hinkley could produce up to 7% of UK's energy needs, UK's electricity needs. Within its total design envelope, you could scale it up and down within that space. So it looks like a scalable system within that range, but it's not scalable to the degree where you could shut it down completely or beyond its design capacity. Whereas Google servers are an example of a much more scalable system. And the property they have is one of repeat applications. So you take a module and you, it's self-similar, it's got a fractal structure like a fungus, and you apply it over and over again. And it's also prone to more technological obsolescence and the new generations of technology being introduced. So interventions, in the interest of time, I'll just go through one slide, which is scalable systems would look a bit more like a fungus, like a fractal structure. They'll have repeat application of self-similar components. They'll have a lot more modularity in design interfaces. And history of computing, from IBM's mainframes in the 1960s to Google servers to the iPhone, pan this out. And another surprising example is a shipping container, which took break bulk cargo, which is a bit like big dams, and turned that into a highly self-similar repeating pattern of modules. And as a result, just to conclude, this is shipping back in the day, highly manual, messy, a bit like dam building. This is ships today. So small modular doesn't necessarily mean small systems. You can end up with huge ships, you know, many, many times the size of a blue whale. But underlying it are highly decomposed standardized components, which have then led to an absolute boom in international trade since the 1960s. Thank you very much for your time.